welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. Just a quick word of warning about the fall, what you're about to hear. It was recorded on a mobile phone because we had some technical issues with Skype. And it, therefore, Charlie, who's the person you're about to I'm interviewing, sounds really good. I, however, sound like I'm shouting down the microphone and it's really quite blurry. However, persevere. The stuff Charlie says is fantastic, and if you can get past me and my booming voice, there's a really good chat here to be had, all about soundtracks. So enjoy.
Okay, right. Hello there, and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. Today we a different to our scheduled show. I will do the final footage episode next week. But I got the opportunity to talk to Charlie Brinkton, who's on the line to us now. We're speaking via mobile phone, so hopefully the sound quality will be good. One of us will probably sound like we're in a tin bath, but the other one will be crystal clear, no doubt. Charlie's just launched. Would you call it an offshoot of your main podcast?
I guess so, yeah. So, I'm trying to keep it separate from everything else. So it's kind of like call it a side project. It's a bit pretentious.
Okay. So your main podcast is Movie Drone, which is based on soundtracks. And this specifically, and the reason why one of the reasons why I'm talking to you is, The Sound of Fear, which is a 6-part project looking at horror soundtracks. So I suppose the first question would be, why you decided to do this project. It's kind of it's separate. I mean, the Movie Drone podcast itself is very good. I know you've been trialing out different things recently to mix up the format of that, but then this kind of Sound of Fear is quite separate. And I was just wondering, what your thought process was, really.
I guess horror has always been kind of the genre kind of closest to my heart, just in general. So kind of just growing up from kind of like the early days of the kind of video nasties and stuff like that, and then watching The Evil Dead when I was like 5 years old, and things like that. And then, starting to do these podcasts, and I've always kind of been interested in doing ones that kind of deconstruct things a bit and kind of a more kind of documentary style, and kind of something that just kind of maybe opens them up a bit more to the mainstream audiences, I guess, because soundtracks the film score soundtracks as opposed to the normal soundtracks that you think of with all the kind of songs on the stuff are have always been kind of like a real niche area, and most of the time, unless it's something huge like something like Bernard Herrmann or John Williams or something like that, the process is kind of like ignored. And even in kind of like a lot of the kind of behind the scenes stuff and all you get, it's not something that's terribly looked at in any kind of detail. I did a couple of things with when I started Movie Drone as a podcast and doing kind of things like basically just kind of doing kind of underappreciated kind of scores and stuff, and just kind of staying away from stuff that other people had maybe looked at. But always in the back of my mind was something to do something with horror. Mainly because I love it so much and because there's so much great music from it. It's something that a lot of people are really, really into. And horror is certainly a genre that no matter how many people kind of, put it down and kind of slag it off a bit, it's still one of those genres that kind of always does really, really well. Obviously you see all the horror films out at the cinemas and all the time, so it's kind of natural for that. And also because horror, more than any other kind of film genre really, is so predicated on the sound aspect and how important that is. So certainly with that, the score as well. And you think of all the great horror films, and then you can immediately think of their scores as well, and how that is applied to how good they are. So that was something I just wanted to kind of highlight as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that really stood out to me, certainly listening to that first episode, which is the only one that's out at the moment, is how it's very much grounded in the history of film as well. I mean, you know, obviously, I think possibly listeners who haven't listened to the podcast yet would be surprised to hear that, you know, that first episode quite excitingly talks about the silent era. And, you know, so your initial, you know, and that's what surprised me. Cause I mean, when I've done history kind of podcasts myself in the past. And when you talk about silent, you're kind of hamstrung a little bit in terms of trying to explain stuff. But what you did there was kind of break that. And kind of explain that it's more, you know, this idea that film was silent is a myth, as it were, that it was. When you did it, I think I didn't realize, and I think it'd be good to really talk about that, you know, that Nosferatu soundtrack, that there was a soundtrack to that film, effectively, it had been written. And, you know, it was, but how does that work? Was it like almost like a suggestion of what people should play? Or was it kind of more intrinsically tied, do you think?
Well, the original soundtrack was kind of built on just kind of musical ideas from various kind of composers.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I talked about in there, which was basically these two composers, Giuseppe Becke and the composer of Nosferatu, Hans Erdmann, basically wrote a manual. And in this manual was just a bunch of kind of pieces of classical music and all kinds of other music, basically to say, play this for a certain mood. So you play this when it's romantic, or you play this when it's going to get scary and fierce, and just basically say, composers at the time, or even the people that were just kind of doing it just in the actual orchestras or organs on the in the actual cinemas could just kind of do it from there. But in that was the score that Erdmann had written for Nosferatu. I mean, it's still kind of relatively kind of based on more kind of general classical kind of moods. The people that kind of reconstructed it just went back to this book and kind of interpreted it the best way they could, to be able to kind of fit that, to the film as it is now. So you can buy the, I think it's just the Masters of Cinema one.
Yeah.
Cause Nosferatu is, you can buy, I don't know how many millions of versions of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm assuming it's public domain.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So people, and because it's a silent film, people can just put any soundtrack on it. So the Masters of Cinema time is Masters of Cinema version is really the kind of the only real version that's got an actual accurate score as it was back when it was released in 1922.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in itself is fascinating. I mean, I'm looking forward to your next episode, mainly because if you look at, like, you know, again, like kind of telling the story of cinema. The Universal Monsters kind of crosses this really amazing kind of period of cinema in screen. You know, you go from silent era with you know, Lon Chaney's Phantom of the Opera, and then right the way through to 3D with, you know, the Creature from the Black Lagoon and everything in between. You know, so the real pain of moving to talkies can be evidenced in, you know, Todd Browning and really wrestling with Dracula. And wrestling with a god awful script as well. it always amuses me when people say they love that version of Dracula. It's like they stand in rooms for hours talking. It's like it's such a long 75 minutes. Then you've got the big bombast and all the money that he put down on Bride of Frankenstein, and then it kind of pieces off, if we're being honest, as you kind of, you know, that horror cycle. But I mean, are you seeing this as a way kind of to tell the story of film through its music? Is that one of the aims of the podcast?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to keep it vaguely kind of chronological. I mean, I'm looking to my right at the moment and I've got a huge number of post-it notes on the wall with all the different areas and some kind of, it's kind of, I mean, the first initial, because I mean, the six episodes is just the initial kind of story really, and there'll be loads of stuff after that. Yeah. But it was just taking those six episodes and thinking, okay, so I've got what is essentially 3 hours here, because about half an hour each. What is important to tell? What do I need to cover? Without going on too much of a tangent, because just kind of how much focus do I want to give to certain things? So with, like for instance, Universal needs a separate focus because, like you said, it was such a massive thing. And there's so many interesting stories behind that. You mentioned Creature from the Black Lagoon. Creature from the Black Lagoon doesn't actually have an original score.
Does it not?
All the music in Creature from the Black Lagoon is taken from other Universal Pictures.
Really? That's amazing. Why was that? I don't want to preempt your podcast.
Just kind of cost and things like that, mainly. I mean, you look at especially in the 50s, these kind of B-movies that they were doing. Yeah. Because that was a beautiful thing about the Universal Pictures in the 30s is that they were B-movies, but they were eventually treated with such a care. And because of people like James Whale, obviously, the budget went up and they were finally almost treated as A-pictures, really.
Yeah.
And then you get to the 50s and kind of you have all the monster movies and things like that. I mean, Tarantulas is the same thing. I mean, it's not like completely just other music. What they do is they pick all the pieces from other films that they were going to use, and then they get a composer in to go in and record with the orchestra just little transition pieces to make it fit together better.
Yeah.
So it doesn't sound as awkward. So I mean, you had Tarantula, which is another one like that.
Yeah.
But one of the composers that worked on Tarantula was Henry Mancini.
Wow.
Yeah. So you had him, and they used some of his previous stuff as well.
Yeah.
I really hate myself because I can't remember the name of the other composer that we worked on. But it's funny because a lot of people kind of see Tarantula as an early Henry Mancini score.
Yeah.
But it's actually really kind of a bit more 70-30 towards the favour of this other guy.
I would both desperately now type it in Tarantula.
You can wait for the episode.
Excellent.
When Universal started out, and Carl Laemmle Jr. Really hated music in his films, and there was like a policy that Universal had that they didn't want music under any actual scenes in the film.
Really?
Which is why they only had it at the beginning and the end, because I mean, Frankenstein had an actual composed main title.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Dracula, just used,
Swan Lake, isn't it?
Swan Lake, yeah, which was also used by Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Mummy as well.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit of a theme for them. And then you get to Bride of Frankenstein, and then it links back to King Kong in the first episode.
Yeah.
And the way Steiner kind of brought in all the techniques there, and then Franz Waxman with Bride of Frankenstein evolved that further.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it's ridiculous how sophisticated that score is.
Yeah.
I mean, the film certainly as well.
It's an absolute piece. I mean, you know,
it's just the joy I have in just kind of explaining that, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, you know, I think, people who listen to my podcast are bored by it, no doubt, will be bored by my constant banging on that. You can tell an awful lot about cinema and about society from the horror films that people watch. And they reflect the times, no matter what those times are traditionally. I think that's as true with Universal. It is just a through point, and you know, it kind of, you know, the Universal monsters kind of drops everyone off into like the 50s when everyone starts looking up to the skies and aliens, and what they're really talking about is communism. We'll go into that. That's a different story for a different day. But for yourself, what do you think makes a good soundtrack? Now, I suppose there's two parts to that question. One is, you know, the soundtrack as a physical medium that you can purchase in a shop. And then there's the soundtrack as a job, something that does its job for a film.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that always has to be taken into consideration is the kind of the primary role of a soundtrack or a score is to serve the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of looking at those things in two ways, and especially as being as someone that reviews soundtracks but doesn't generally get to see a lot of the films that those soundtracks are from before I review the soundtrack.
Okay.
So it's kind of like I'll review the soundtrack and then a few weeks later I'll see the film. Especially since I get the majority of mine from America, where generally the films aren't out yet.
Yeah.
So it's kind of being able to see that. I mean, a nice recent example, not horror, but the film Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to hear that and then listen to, and then see the film straight away. And it was really nice to kind of compare those two. In the film, it's kind of tricky, but I don't know if it's just me being a kind of a film music fan, but I've never really adhered to the kind of concept that, you shouldn't hear the score. Or you should notice the score. It's got to be something that fits naturally with all the other elements.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, the best kind of scores are something that kind of underline the emotions and kind of the subtext that the characters aren't just allowed to come out and say, or events or what have you. But without kind of making that too obvious.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think, you know, I mean, when you talk about some of the John, you know, the classic John Williams scores, I think they're kind of designed to kind of almost, you know, increase the bombast of the film that's shown, you know. Not, if you take, I'm assuming this is a John Williams score, but Back to the Future soundtrack, that seems almost designed to kind of, you know, when effectively what you're really just watching is a car speed away, kind of make it more exciting and kind of add more impact. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. And yeah, no, it wasn't John Williams.
Okay, sorry.
No, sorry, it was a guy called Alan Silvestri. He did the score for Predator as well.
Oh, uh-huh, cool.
And if you listen to both of them, you can tell. You're very kind of definite style. No, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And certainly John Williams is an interesting one, because John Williams is someone who, you think of John Williams, you think of Star Wars and kind of Superman and things like that, and you think of the kind of bombast. But also, when you think about the kind of the horror scores he has done as well.
Yeah.
I mean, Jaws is the obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did a Robert Altman film called Images, in the early 70s, which was kind of a much more kind of avant-garde and a kind of feel to it. And then you had, The Fury, which he did for Brian De Palma.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that. And then even kind of elements of Jurassic Park and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of really kind of nice different approaches. He also did a version of Dracula. It's actually a Universal version that was done in 1979.
All right.
It was one that was much more kind of romantic.
Is that the Frank Langella film?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. It plays up the rather creepy quite a lot.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. With horror, it's kind of like making sure that the sound is absolutely perfect, and because so much of sound in our daily lives is such a suggestive thing.
Yeah.
So certainly, I mean, there's one, I'm not going to be able to cover it much in the podcast. I'll mention it occasionally, I'll mention it at one point, but the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which kind of, I think people probably don't even know, maybe has a score.
I was going to say, it wouldn't be something that would initially, I mean, obviously there's the camera flash stuff at the start with the,
yeah,
that kind of discordant scream. Yeah.
Yeah. And, Toby Hooper and, the sound guy Wayne Bell, just basically kind of used all these kind of found sounds and recorded all these really weird things. And it works for me. It works for that, as a reflection of the way the film is in terms of just a complete kind of assault. And also because of the kind of all the different kind of things that are used, like the chainsaw and the hammer and the meat hook and all the kind of, all these metallic things, that it works with that as well. And is able to kind of create something that, is really, really effective and just adds absolutely to the texture of the film,
mm-hmm,
without really making it stand out amongst any other thing.
Yeah, cool. I suppose I think one of the things particularly about horror soundtracks now is that they're seen as collectible items almost, you know, through to probably because of, you know, Mondo and Death Wolf's records have created a market for vinyl, specifically for soundtracks. Is this some? I mean, obviously, you know, but that is definitely something that's happening. I think I'm just curious about your take on how that market currently is. Do you think it's still thriving, or do you? I mean, my feeling is possibly that there are only a finite number of soundtracks like that you can put out there. And when you look at maybe putting them, you know, putting out something like the Cannibal Apocalypse soundtrack, kind of it is an indication that, you know, there is a finite amount of stuff that there might be a market for. Would you agree, or am I being a bit harsh?
I think you're being a bit harsh there. I think the market in general at the moment is perhaps a bit oversaturated. I simply myself personally cannot afford to do that anymore, because there's so much out there, and also so much of it as well is produced in America, so then with all the import costs, and over here you look at some of the kind of like Waxwork, for instance, and some of the Mondo stuff as well, If you walk into your local record store or even HMV or something like that, you'll see those on the shelf, which is amazing. But you see that they cost 35, 40 quid.
Yeah.
And things like that. And so, yeah, I'm someone that has to really kind of, I pick and choose. It's like, I have to get something, that I really, really love or that is going to really, really interest me.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to spend that much money on something.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I like it because it's kind of, yeah, they are releasing a lot of kind of obscure kind of things, but in the same kind of vein, it's nice that they're being able to do that and being able to, have people kind of listen to these things. Because some of them, I mean, Cannibal Apocalypse, is a really good score. And just, it's got some really interesting music in it. And then you've got stuff as well, they're releasing like Killer Nun and things like that.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were doing that.
I might get that.
Yeah, they did that and they did Miss 45 and.
Yeah.
It's kind of. It almost adds a new layer of appreciation on these films.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many of these films, have been kind of dogged for so long. Whether it's just by kind of general kind of feeling towards the horror films and certainly some of the kind of gorier stuff or the kind of, the echoes of the video nasties and that whole thing.
Yeah.
But it's kind of looking at these films and even beyond what you think of the actual film is seeing that they have some other intrinsic value. Perhaps see the music. I mean, it's one rule that most soundtrack fans know is that, if you want to collect soundtracks, you need to separate the film from the soundtrack because a lot of them are shit.
Yes.
So, I mean, Jerry Goldsmith, for example, is an amazing composer, but so many films that he composed were absolutely dire. But the amazing thing is he was able to create great music for those.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at something like Omen 3, which I like the film. I enjoy it quite a lot. But I kind of realize as well that it's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But the music he composed for that film is arguably the best of the three.
Yeah.
I mean, so you kind of have stuff because they released the Carlo Morricone score to Absurd.
Yeah.
I can never pronounce it, but Anthropophagus 2.
Yeah.
And that's a really nice score.
It is a very nice score. I purchased that score only last week. I was like presenting to myself a couple of weeks ago. but again, I mean, on an unrelated note, that you were saying about a couple of things occurred to me when with Absurd. One was that I did a podcast about that film maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I wasn't down on the soundtrack. I can't really remember, but someone pointed out to me that I'd kind of said that it's influenced by Halloween and Carpenter. And I also said that all this synth that permeates the 80s sounds quite dated now and isn't very fashionable. And then the guy just tweeted me like, "How fucking wrong are you?" I stand by 2012 Chris's opinion that it wasn't fashionable in 2012, and that it's obviously just been everywhere in the last 5 years.
I mean, that's the thing as well is when you're watching these films is that, especially because a lot of the budget of these films, they don't sound especially good.
Mm.
And then the music doesn't always sound especially good. But with kind of like the vinyl and things like that, where they go back to the actual master tapes and things like that, and makes these scores sound so much better than they generally do in the film.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right about the synth has just kind of exploded back.
Yeah. I think that's interesting as well, though, because you're talking about going back to the past tapes. It's almost that the Video Nasties in particular, they're so tied to the medium. And that, you're talking about, Anthropophagus the Beast. I did a screening of that film in a cinema in Liverpool, a couple of years ago now. And it was in HD. It was that 88 films released in HD.
Yeah.
And HD is not kind to that film. Not kind at all. But that's that grossiness in the tape kind of, made the violence look better because it looked more believable because it doesn't look quite so rubbery. But also, I suppose it is detrimental to the sound of the film though, because you're used to the first time I watched that film, it was on a tape and it was on a portable TV, and I'm guessing the speakers were not exactly great, I've got vivid memories of it apart from just going, what is this anything about it? This is insane. Would you agree that it's almost tied to it, that kind of
absolutely. And it's going back to Texas Chainsaw, I still maintain to this day that the best way to watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre is on a small TV, on a third generation copy on VHS.
Yeah, yeah. That's
because cool. I remember in 99 when, they finally released it over here in the cinema.
Yeah.
And I went to see it in the cinema a few times, and it was, I previously had the, I imported the DVD, and so I kind of knew how good it really looked, but it looks absolutely beautiful, and it is a beautifully shot film. But a couple of people that I went to see it with who had never seen it before kind of didn't kind of really get the fuss about it.
Yeah.
And then a week or so later, I was at a party with, and those same people were there, and someone had a copy of the old Ivor, VHS,
mm-hmm.
the preset, and put it on. And these people were kind of transfixed.
Yeah.
By watching it in this, I guess for me, because it almost, there's this kind of meta thing there when it almost does feel like a snuff film.
Yeah.
And certainly the legacy and the history that Chainsaw has. Where for so long in this, at least in this country. Yeah, so the kind of the history and legacy that Chainsaw has kind of really kind of added to this. So this kind of idea of this grotty little film that, is just and again, the kind of rumors about it, and that it was wall to wall murder and blood and gore and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
When the fact is that, yeah, again, it's all from suggestiveness rather than anything.
I was going to say it's because at a juncture in time, videotape was considered dangerous. It was like a dangerous medium, a corruptive influence, like contraband. And I suppose, regardless of, I always kind of think that Toby Hooper, when he says it, it's kind of making it a bit of a joke that, he pitched it for a PG.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, you say enough times, you get support enough times, it kind of like emanates like a bit like fat. Although a lot of his interviews, he just kind of says whatever occurs to him.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Regardless of that, and it's kind of bloodlessness. It was perceived to be dangerous, physically dangerous.
Yeah.
And, the best marketed in the world for a horror film.
And it's almost as if that was our punk.
Yeah.
At least my generation. because I was too young for punk.
Yeah.
But that kind of attitude that was given to punk by the establishment was then given to video and horror.
Absolutely. And I don't know about yourself, but I was as a young man, was basically dealing in tapes a lot of the time.
Yeah, no,
that was the dodgy lad's behaviour as a scouter was a video tape rather than more shifty than that. So I think I always tell this story. This wasn't like, and there was a car park meetup, and they were handed out video tapes, and it was the nasties, basically nasties. It wasn't anything more than that, and. So they're doing the deals, and not the police, because the police don't care. Trading standards rock up at this meeting, and literally, like, all the lads just put everything back in the bag, lash the bags in the car, and do one. So the two, my mate and his mate, basically, lash the tapes in the boot, get in the car, get off. Then a lad runs up and dives through the back window to get away from the fucking trading standards. It's like, it's just fucking, I don't know what you're doing. The worst thing that's going to happen is they confiscate your tapes. It's just preposterous. But I mean, that is as an illicitness. I mean, how exciting that must have been, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I never had to run away from the busies. But, you know, I just found it fascinating. But I think that all feeds into the same thing, you know, that it has a there's a grain to it, not just beyond the 16 mil grain. There's an actual physical grain to VHS that warps and bleeds together that makes it feel far more dangerous than, you know, the HD copy that I've got upstairs at the moment. It looks lovely on my projector, but it isn't quite the same experience, you know.
Yeah, but then you've got that link. So when you walk into a record shop and you see a copy of Last House on the Left, on vinyl.
Yeah.
You think, oh my God, that was such kind of, that's just, even the title just screams out to people. So that's, again, is a thing to kind of, that attracts people.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, again, that's a very unusual soundtrack. Jesus, I mean, obviously Wes Craven really struggled to get a second film after that movie. I think it gets played that it's because, you know, Last House was so notorious, but I think a lot of it's because people would look at that film and say, why did you put the police in there? Why is this film structured like this?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then what's with the chickens?
The chickens, right?
And the score, the music is crazy. And kind of like the rag song about Sadie and Krug.
I suppose we should explain. It's David Hess, basically. So it's Krug. The guy who plays that did a very extensive soundtrack. There's a lot of songs on there. There's a ragtime number kind of that makes the that to be like kind of cutesy outlaws, kind of like in a Bonnie and Clyde kind of way. And there is nothing in that film that makes them look like Bonnie and Clyde.
No, absolutely not.
But again, you know, a fantastic. I mean, it's one I've got, and it's a lovely thing to have. I have to say it's not something that I put on very often, but I just. You know, as a different thing, say, for example, if you were somebody who's listening to this, kind of was thinking, well, maybe I should get a record player, or a new record player, and what kind of soundtracks do you think they should be looking at? They're a horror fan, the kind of people that would probably, you know, listen to what we're talking about right now, I suppose would be the best way to put it. Where would you point people initially?
Right, I suppose Death Waltz is kind of the record. Just go to Discogs and look at the Death Waltz catalog, because you've got all the stuff that's in there. They just kind of released kind of the Bruno Nicolai stuff, like kind of Case of the Scorpion's Tail and things like that, all the giallos.
Yeah.
And they kind of, unfortunately it's out of print, but Silver have released that, which is The Fog. Mm. They did an amazing version of that. And they've done Halloween 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Halloween 3 in particular is such an amazing soundtrack.
It is amazing.
But then you can go in, to wherever and get, Jaws, you can get Bride of Frankenstein, Silver have just released a rescore of Nosferatu, the one that was done by James Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's also released the score that Philip Glass and the Kronos Quartet did for, the Browning Dracula.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the different labels. So you've got like the One Way Static, who did Last House on the Left, and they've also just done The Burning, which is a great album.
Mm-hmm.
And Waxwork have just done The Thing, and they've done some earlier really cool stuff, like they did Creepshow as well.
Yeah.
So it's always difficult because there is so much out there.
Yeah.
And because of that, there's a few kind of bootlegs that make it out there as well. Like there's this, a Psycho bootleg, that has made the rounds with various cover art for a few years now. That's, you'll find it over here because, Britain has an odd copyright law where it's kind of, if it's older than 50 years, then that kind of, in some arcane way, releases it from copyright. But then people use that as a loophole to be able to release, kind of stuff that they don't have the rights to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a weird, I might be wrong here, but I think it's a weird law that it's out of copyright, but only that pressing. So, like, if it was like a CD version, that, and you took that copy and tried to sell it on, that would be, that you'd be breaching copyright. But if you took like an original record and tried to take that and then clean that up, that would be okay, which makes my head hurt.
The Psycho one that's out there, it's taken from the Laserdisc from the mid 90s, the signature edition Universal Laserdisc, where they did a music only track.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've taken that out, haven't really done much to it because you can still kind of hear where the kind of, it dips a bit in volume for the dialogue.
Yeah.
And just slap that onto a record.
I'm left here on buying it now. That's all.
Yeah. And you can go into record stores and buy that. Which is kind of amazing. Especially since, the original tracks of Psycho have never been released. Ever. Yeah. Apart from on that Laserdisc. So I guess Bernard Herrmann recorded an album on a Unicorn label in the 70s. I think, or the 60s. So you can go out and buy that one, and it's really good. And there's all sorts of re-recordings and stuff like that out there. But yeah, so stuff like that. But yeah, because it's such a huge market now.
Yeah.
Then there's just kind of, there's, like you said, I don't know if it is finite because I don't think there's any limit to imaginations, and also because Defaults have agreements with Beat Records in Italy, so that's where they kind of, they're able to release a lot of the more obscure Italian stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you think of how many scores Morricone recorded, and how many of those were horror as well. And there's still some big ones out there that haven't been released.
Yeah. Just thinking about that now, as you with Morricone, because they put out the Black Belly of Tarantula, which is a great score for an absolutely god-awful film.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I think, again, as you were saying before, it's kind of, one of those things where I didn't know it was my opponent's good, but it's just one of those kind of sleazy shallows that you're just like, well, that just is just a sleazy shallows. It's not, you know, particularly brilliantly put together, but to get like obviously this amazing Morricone score and it does kind of elevate it somewhat.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing though. You had all the Gialles are just a great bed of talent because you had Morricone, you have Bruno Nicolai, and then you have kind of Stelvio Cipriani and people like that, and Piero Umiliani. So you have all these kind of crazy Gialles. And they made so many of them as well.
Yeah.
And then obviously from that, you have the Goblin stuff as well and Deep Red and then going to the kind of other Argento films.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, you just have, there's so much there just from the Giallos that is just getting put out, which is, some of it's really, I mean, Cipriani certainly is a composer for me that's really underrated or just underheard. And he's done some beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, yeah, for me, it's just nice to see some of these composers, get a lot more, exposure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, I think I might wrap it up there because that seems like a nice place to finish the chat. Cool. Thanks very much. So where's the best place to get hold of your content?
Okay, so at the moment, it's all on my Patreon page, mm-hmm. which is patreon.com/soundtheorpod.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow me on Movie Drone, that's our Twitter name, Movie Drone, and the Twitter name for the podcast is soundtheorpod.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for that chat. That's been really great, and I'm sure the listeners will really enjoy it.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, it's been great. And we've been talking about doing it for a while, haven't we?
Yeah. On Twitter
before Christmas. And when I listened to that first episode, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, let's get this done. I can't praise it highly enough. I thought, as an opening gambit, that first episode's absolutely fantastic. Really, really enjoyed it. So thanks very much. And yeah, cheers again. Take care.
Yeah, no worries. Take care, mate.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
Episodes are on there. You can click on mixtapes and I will send you out a mixtape which this week will no doubt feature some of the music that we've been talking about today in that chat, because it makes sense too, doesn't it, really? And also, if you are so inclined and want to support the show, you can click on the Buy Me a Coffee link and just a little link to PayPal. And thanks very much to Ask Hasselback, who sent me all the way from Copenhagen, sent me a coffee, which was very kind of him. So cheers for that. I'm glad you enjoyed the show. Or you can get me on Twitter, which is @orange_monkey. So next week, I promise you, I will do this thing about fan footage. It is good. It will be good. It is a well-argued piece for once. But again, massive thanks to Charlie for doing that today. It's always a pleasure to talk to somebody with such great knowledge and depth of knowledge, and he really knows his stuff. So if you get a chance, do go to the to his website, to his Patreon page, and get involved, because I'm telling you, that first episode is excellent. Anyway, till next time, take care, speak to you soon.